Okay. Happy Wednesday, everyone. Thanks for joining me. Rabbi Kelman's not here to introduce. He's teaching right now, but welcome to Adventures in American Judaism. It's fun to be back. It's great to be back and to learn with all of you. Really, this is a potpourri of interesting adventures. My teacher, Jonathan Sarna, always says that machloket is your friend if you're a historian. Not if you're a lay leader or a nonprofit professional, but machloket is your friend if you're a historian. And so what I want to look at really over the next 10 weeks is a series of events, not necessarily connected, but through their tensions, we can maybe parse out certain themes. In some instances, we're going to look at things that are truly brand new. I mean, nothing is brand new in history. It, by dint of being history, is not brand new. But some episodes, like what we're going to explore today, are better known. And that is the real mischievous activity that took place at the Grand Union Hotel in 1877. So I will share my screen. And by all means, if there are any questions, place them to the chat, or if it's pressing, certainly unmute. And but as much as Zoom can be, let's be interactive. The Grand Union Hotel and its Jewish in crowd. This is not, like I said, an unknown event. To the contrary, in Irving Howe's estimation, writing in his memoiristic book published about 50 years ago, discrimination against Jews began to be practiced in a serious way some years after the Civil War, perhaps. The most notorious instance being the refusal in 1877 by a leading Saratoga Springs hotel to receive the German Jewish banker Joseph Seligman. In the years that followed, there were a good many similar exclusions, but while arousing strong protests, these did not closely affect the lives of most immigrant Jews. So for Howe, the most celebrated instance of anti-Semitism in the United States, and he's absolutely correct. While there are certainly instances of anti-Jewish sentiment, you only need to go back to 1654 with the arrival of 23 Jews and then New Amsterdam, where Peter Stuyvesant was rather unhospitable to those Jews who were fleeing the Inquisition, the Portuguese Inquisition. In Brazil, there was always anti-Jewish sentiment, but as a trend, as a movement, it really begins with the Civil War. Naomi Cohn, a really remarkable historian who passed away just a few years ago, in an essay she writes, and she studied many things, American Zionism, studied our period in the German Jewish migration, but also wrote quite a bit about anti-Semitism, writes the following: the private sector contributed its share in addition to discriminatory policies of financial and credit institutions. There were schools, social clubs, professional organizations, and summer resorts. And all that years before the overplayed Seligman Hilton affair of 1877. And so for Naomi Cohn, and really in her time, along with Jacob Rader Marcus, was the most remarkable American Jewish historian in her own right. Sometimes she's known as being the wife of Gerson Cohn, the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is true. But in her own right, Naomi Cohn was a really special and spectacular scholar and teacher. She downplays the Seligman Hilton affair was picked up by Howe and others. But in fact, if you really want to look at anti-Semitism, you really have to find it some decades later, particularly the beginning of the 20th century. So I want to introduce some of our characters today. A.M. Stewart was a millionaire, maybe we correct for inflation, billionaire. And he had this darling. of an institution. He buys not long before the Seligman Hilton affair, the Grand Union Hotel in Saratoga Springs. That's a very important site. It was a conduit, a connector city, for people traveling from Boston, Albany, New York, Ohio, Detroit. And as people, Americans, Jews included, but Americans are moving westward, Saratoga becomes a major site for railroad activity and also becomes a vacation spot. Stewart invested quite a bit. We'll see in a little bit. And he left when he passed away. Also, he only owned it for a few years. When he passes away, he leaves the management of his baby, his darling institution, the Grand Union Hotel, which he built up quite a bit, to Henry Hilton. And he's on our right. The other person who we need to talk about is Joseph Seligman. Is born, I believe, in 1819, comes to the country, born in Germany, or in the German area. It wasn't Germany until the unification in 1871, but comes to the United States in around 1840. And he has that typical Horatio, not typical, but that Horatio Alger-like Jewish immigrant story to the United States. We don't know much about his early travels, but essentially comes in as a poor immigrant, poor, I should say, because it costs a lot of money to travel to the United States. They became poor because they invested in that travel, comes in, and he elevates from peddling with a pack on the shoulder to opening a convenience store to becoming a very prominent banker. Say something about the banking industry and how that transforms. That's also a credit to the Civil War. If you want some reading material on it, my good friend Adam Mendelsohn, professor in South Africa right now, won a lot of awards for his book probably around 8 years ago. The Rags Race is what it's called. He's written a number of articles too. But the Civil War is a major determinant of change for Jewish wealth because Jews are well set up to trade in the used clothing industry because soldiers need clothing and very particular clothing. Secondhand clothing was still very substantial, but it was made, the material was made with, but also the business for it. And Jews, because they had a social network, because if I landed and spent some time in Klein Deutschland, the little German area, now we call it the Lower East Side, and I was sent by a landsman, right, somebody I knew from Eichenstadt, or a relative who sends me en route to Cincinnati or Albany or Baltimore, Philadelphia, I'm coming to the United States because I trust in my social network. And Jews leverage, particularly in the Civil War, those social ties. And because they are already working in the peddling, so to speak, industry, they make something of it. Jews live in the North and in the South. And so they have quick access, argues Mendelssohn, to used clothing, and particularly because there's a need for, because of the soldiering that's going on in the Civil War. Not every Jew, certainly, not most Jews, but many Jews arrive at unprecedented wealth, and that then moves them into financing and with new technologies in communication and the railroad. Jews leverage the systems that they have, and not again, not most, but a number of Jews, including Seligman, become very wealthy around this time. So what happens? The front page of the New York Times reports the following. It's got right over here. It's a little bit small. I know, a sensation at Saratoga. On Wednesday last, Joseph Seligman, the well-known baker of this city and a member me. Blow it up a little bit. A place of government. So he's a very important person in business. Visited Saratoga with his wife and family for 10 years. He has spent the summer at the Grand Union Hotel. His family entered the room. Sorry that it's for some reason it's not very clear, but essentially what happens is he goes to the front desk, does Seligman. He goes to the manager and he asks for his usual room. Now, what we actually know, not from this report, was that the rail had broken down and the Seligman family was in need of a place to stay. So they made their way to Saratoga Springs. They weren't vacationing there. It just so happened that they need to be there. And that's again why it's important that there is this conduit for various levels of travel. They end up in Saratoga. So the manager looks at Seligman after he asks for a room. Mr. Seligman, I am sorry to inform you that Mr. Hilton, by now A.M. Stewart has passed away, and Seligman, though A.M. Hilton is now instituting Henry Hilton rather is instituting the policies, inform you that Mr. Hilton has given instructions that no Israelites, he probably didn't say that, and you'll see why, will be permitted for the use of the hotel. Mr. Seligman was so astonished for some time that he couldn't even make a reply. Then he said, "Do you mean to tell me that you will not entertain Jewish people?" "This is our orders, sir," was the reply. Before leaving, the banker asked the reason why Jews was were let me read it. I'm sorry. Were persecuted, said he, the manager, or sorry, Seligman. What are they to do? Have they done anything wrong? "Oh no," replied the manager. "There is no fault in that respect. The reason is simply that business at the hotel has not been good last season, and we had a large number of Jews here." So they make the connection. They make the connection that it must be, if business wasn't so great in 1877, it must be that the reason why is because they were patroned the previous summer by Jews and they need to make a change. See, there's something in the chat. I want to make sure that I catch everybody. No, this is not the same Hilton. You are very free to freak no matter what the outcome of this talk and our learning today. Don't make the connection. Hiltons are quite fine. It's not an endorsement of any current hotels or lack thereof. It's a good question, though. So the New York Times, again, on its front page, on the very top, start to raise the issue. And they interview both Seligman and Hilton. Seligman is calling for a boycott of the Grand Union Hotel. And if we see over here in the next Judge Hilton's statement in the evening, a reporter of the Times, the New York Times, called upon Judge Hilton, excuse me, to his residence and found him willing to speak upon the subject. He said that Mr. Seligman was not ejected from the Grand Union. He had been boarding at the Calderon, another hotel, and the time of the opening of the Grand Union. So he said he's not even that much of a patron. He then came over and in an ostentatious manner, he wanted his room. Now it actually wasn't so. As I explained, what happened was his train broke down and he needed a place to lodge and for he and his family. Now, what's also really interesting, and I apologize that this text is just not so legible, is that he makes another comment, does Henry Hilton, about the types of Jews. Judge Hilton does not consider Mr. Joseph Seligman a Hebrew. Years ago, he said, Mr. Seligman absolutely threw overboard his Hebrew Bible and Moses, and he now belongs to the Adler set of liberals. The Adler set of liberals? Wonder what he means. So, Mr. Seligman is a Jew, in quotation marks. You can see my cursor over here. In the trade sense of the word, in the class of Jews he represents, while they are not forbidden to come to the Grand Union, are not encouraged to come. So apparently, he's not a Hebrew. He's a Jew, explains Judge Henry Hilton about Seligman's type and who is welcome and who's not welcome at the Grand Union Hotel. We have a lot of people here, but maybe I want to see there's a question. Sounds like a gentleman's agreement. Yeah, there is something like that here from that important book turned movie. Good. Here we have. So both people were both here, Naomi and Justin, also saw echoes of gentleman's agreement, which of course was some 70 years later, but very interesting. What's the difference between a Hebrew and a Jew? Maybe you want to unmute. What is, if we're all historians here, I want to offer a hypothesis. What does he mean by that?
I would think there's no difference.
You would think, but to Hilton, so to your mind, Susanna, there is no difference. But if
blood
you had
versus,
to,
there
yes.
is. We
blood
started out
versus
as
faith.
Hebrews. We later became Israelites. And only after the time of the first temple's destruction did we take on the title Jews. But in America, plenty of times we somehow didn't get so comfortable being called Jews. So we started calling ourselves Hebrews. That was something pretty characteristic of Jews living in America in the 19th century, late 19th century.
You're absolutely correct. So somebody else who wanted to say something? I just want to make sure we have enough space. This is experimental.
Blood versus faith. A practicing Jew versus being born a Jew and converting.
Certainly, and that's in Hilton's explanation. There's something interesting going on here. And I think everybody is absolutely correct in that. If you think so, no, and there is this historical view of what they are. Remember, if you drive up from New York to Boston, if you're in Connecticut, I just did that with my son this past weekend. You see that there are these very biblical cities. There's New Canaan, there's Salem. There are these very Bamidbar type of geography going on in cities and areas that were named in not even the early Republic in the colonial period. And think about the Pilgrims. Think about the Puritans. They really thought they were coming to new canon. They were coming to a new place. It's really biblical.
Everybody
moves.
Very good.
So A.T., I think I said A.M., but A.T. Stewart, but before we get back to him, there is an idea both Jews and non-Jews understand that there are the Israelite Jews, Israelites, Hebrews, very biblical terms. These are the Jews of the Bible. These are the Jews who understand that. In fact, America, which was mostly Christian, really valued their Bible at this time. And Jews actually, Dr. Jonathan Sarna and Dr. Nachum Sarna co-wrote a chapter. Can't imagine that was easy for either of them. On the history of biblical commentary in the United States, and sort of synthesized both of their expertise. It's a fabulous chapter. And non-Jews really look to Jews to translate, to be the custodians of the Bible and its translation. And Jews started to own it. So, for example, if you think about all the institutions that were built in the 19th century, you have Hebrew Free Loan, you have Hebrew Union College, you have a newspaper, the American Hebrew, you have another newspaper, the American Israelite. For many
Hebrew
German
Immigrant Aid Society.
Absolutely. So Hebrew becomes a useful term to say, you know what? Jews and non-Jews are owning it. There are these Jews. They are in Europe. We are Israelites. We are Hebrews. We are reimagining our identity here in the United States. So a little bit, I want you, let's meditate on that a little bit. But in the meantime, let me catch you up on A.T. Stewart. who developed for an affection, writes the newspapers. Blow it up a little bit. Developed for, referring to the Grand Union Hotel, an affection as ardent as the late Sultan Abdul Aziz over felt for the palace which he built. He took it from the tired shoulders of the Lelands and expanded it in every way. So A.T. Stewart buys the Grand Union Hotel and he expands it and he makes sure that it has the latest and greatest and unbelievable cuisine from all different areas, not just America, but Europe. And in fact, in the centennial of the Declaration of Independence in 1876, he ramps up and there's cuisine from America and Europe. And as people are traveling from Europe to the United States to celebrate the centennial, they are receiving much business at that time. Later on, they didn't. Which is why Hilton was in a bit of a fret about people coming in. And, but he is making sure that in the vacation spot of New York State, the Grand Union Hotel reigns supreme. And A.T. Stewart wants it to be for as many people as possible. So important. When visiting New York City, you can take carriage, you can take the express here and stop at the Grand Union Hotel opposite the Grand Central Depot. It's right next to the train station at 600 handsomely furnished rooms at $1 and upward per day. European plan has a certain layout, elevators, and all modern conveniences. Restaurants supplied with the best horse cars, stages, and elevated railroads to all depots. You can live better for less money at the Grand Union Hotel than any other first-class hotel in the city. That's really important. And you see, before I unshare for a moment, Hilton claims Mr. A.T. Stewart's intentions when he conceived the idea of the Grand Union Hotel was to test the experiment of a house that should not be guided by the set rules of hotel keeping, but should combine the best features of those rules with a management that would prevail in a large and well-regulated private establishment, private rooms. He calculated to enlarge his guests, his guests a good price, but to relieve them of the petty annoyances and impositions to which hotel visitors are too frequently subjected. He also states later on that he wanted to remove certain riffraff, meaning certain types of Jews. So A.T. Stewart has this business model. He's going to create, he's going to elevate the, he didn't call it the Grand Union Hotel. He buys it from other well-heeled folks named the Lelands. And, but he is going to make it even grander. He is going to bring all sorts of cuisine. He is going to expand the guest rooms, but he's going to charge less than lesser hotels. In other words, he's going to make it up in volume. And he knows that all sorts of people are coming through Saratoga Springs, not just the wealthy, all different types of people on business. And if they have cash for just a dollar a night, now a dollar wasn't what it is now, much more. But his business model is, I am not going to just service the elites. I'm going to make everybody's experience grand in Saratoga Springs. And part of that, despite what Hilton says later on, the editorial that I just showed you, Jews, again, of all types, who are very involved in the Western frontier and the gold rush, they're not digging, it's Levi jeans, all sorts of different areas. Jews who are trading. That's why I mentioned, why I shared Adam Mendelsohn's insight into the Civil War. Jewish commerce is very much reliant on American mobility. And Saratoga Springs becomes the ideal vacation spot for people with certain excess cash, but also people who travel. So Jews are making it to Saratoga Springs. They're punching way above their weight class, so to speak, of where they're vacationing and where they are. Right. Young Men's Hebrew Association is another example of the use of Hebrew over Jews, certainly. It's not in, it's no, the New York Times is reporting in there is, but it's in Saratoga. Were the Sephardi Jews earlier immigrants, Shelley asks, to the U.S. also included in this discrimination? The answer is no. And you're picking up on something very, very important. Me. So Hilton did not invent these naming conventions. Jews in the Jewish Messenger, and I'll put up the next one, in the American Hebrew in the 1860s and later on the 1870s and 1880s, are worried about, well, what do we call ourselves? Names matter. I think I've spoken before with all of you in Torah Motion about the term modern orthodoxy and the challenge that Rabbi Norman Lamb had, first demurring any designation whatsoever, then choosing modern orthodoxy, moving to centrist, then towards the end of his life coming back to modern orthodoxies. We may eschew certain religious or certain Jewish designations, but they're often foisted upon us, and labels do matter. We do have to reckon with a certain rigidity of this taxonomy of these monikers. So Hebrews, Israelites, or Jews, asks an editorial in the Jewish Messenger in New York. Our father Abraham was born in Mesopotamia, the section of a country crossed by the river Euphrates. When commanded by God to quit his native place, he went in the direction of the land of Canaan. To do so, he was obliged to pass over the western side of the same river. Now, the word side in the sacred language is Aver. And as the patriarch was very much known and respected for his sterling qualities, it followed that when spoken of, he was designated by the name of Hebrew or Hebrew, meaning the personage who had emigrated from a city to the eastern side of the Euphrates. The definition of the name Hebrew is not, however, universally accepted. So it's not as if it's very scientific. Some scholars contend it's a derivation, or that's fine. We're not doing biblical Hebrew over here. But whether, going to the next paragraph, whether we admit that Hebrew has its origin in the circumstance of our patriarch expatriation, or in his descent from one of the family of Shem, certain it is that during many centuries, we as a people were known by that appellation. So here is an editorial in the 1860s saying, you know what? Maybe we should go by Hebrews. And what does he want to pack into that? The idea that we are immigrants, the idea that we are biblical. It seems to make sense for an American Jewish population. A little bit later on, again, in a New York newspaper called The American Hebrew, every language has synonyms. They are indicative over here, not merely of the riches and variety of expressions a language has, but also of the varieties and the provisions of the conceptions it embodied in it, and of the great distinctions the rational mind makes between the various departments and spheres from which it receives stimulus and material in the formation of words. A great many are the opinion, skipping to the third paragraph, are of the opinion that we are called Hebrews because our forefathers spoke the Hebrew language, and that we are not Hebrews anymore because the Hebrew is not anymore spoken by our people. This is a very wrong idea. So here's another push to go with Hebrew. Most interesting of all, perhaps, is Isaac Mayer Wise, writing in 1885. Wise, who is the architect of American Reform Judaism, and who has, unclear, I've argued that he wasn't a major factor at the Pittsburgh Rabbinical Conference in the summer of 1885. But he then started to own it more and more in his newspaper in Cincinnati. That Declaration of Principles, which was basically the pronunciation, the articulation of a very rigid reform movement in the United States. Take a look what Wise says. That Declaration of Principles presents in particular feature which must not be overlooked. It declares, and again, it was the casting away of the Talmud, to downplay the divinity of the Bible, denial of the Messiah, of Zion, and the like. It's a very radical position. It declares by its tone and position that we are the much abused reformers, radicals, decried, defamed, and debased by the men of the minority who usurp for themselves the titles of conservative and orthodox, or rather, the Jews par excellence. We are the orthodox Jews in America, and they were the orthodoxy of former days in other countries. Wise claims after the Pittsburgh platform, the articulation, the planks of Reform Judaism, we are orthodox. They were the orthodox, but we are the orthodox now. Maybe I'll stop screen. Maybe we can talk about that for a bit. What's he doing? He's not orthodox. He's the architect of Reform Judaism. But he's also a master polemicist and an excellent rabbinical politician. When Wise says, we are the orthodox, you guys, you're the orthodox of the past, what's happening?
It's claiming the true Judaism in quotation marks.
And in ways, and I've definitely spoken with Torah Motion folks about this before, authenticity. Right? Ooh, I'm hearing a sound. Everybody could make sure they mute. They claim, when you are orthodox, you are claiming a level of authenticity. What does orthodox mean? It means true belief or singular belief. It's not heterodox. When Wise cleverly says, now it doesn't work, obviously. The Central Conference of American Rabbis, which was only founded, well, which would be founded a number of years ago, doesn't say, you know what, we're the new Orthodox Jews. It's polemical in nature. But the idea that you are the authentic type is really important. When certain Jews, and in this case, anti-Semites, like Henry Hilton, will return back to him, are saying, you know what, who's welcome at the Grand Union Hotel? Who's encouraged or not encouraged to come? I'm willing to take the Israelites and the Hebrews, but not the Jews. When you're an Israelite or a Hebrew, you are trying in some literary way to sort of go back to the future, or trying to go back in time rather. Not back to the future, back in time to a more authentic state of Judaism, one in which you can participate. You're a biblical Jew. Nothing's more authentic. When Henry Hilton says, my hotel, A.T. Stewart's hotel, the Stewart family's legacy is available to Hebrews and Israelites, not to Jews, he's making a statement about a certain level of authentic Jew. He's a trade Jew. He's a Jew in name only. His parents were Jews. He says about Seligman, but he's not a Hebrew. I want the real Jews. I want the waspy Jews, so to speak, a certain type. And he says exactly who he wants. I want the Hendrixes and the Nathans. Here's Hendrix. Here's Nathan. And here's Mrs. Nathan. I want the Jews who migrated to the United States in the 1700s, who have established regal communities, who have been lay leaders in synagogue, in which they have a certain level of comportment, a certain level of orthodoxy, of tradition. I want the Sherith Israel, Spanish Portuguese Jews. I want the Mikveh Israel Jews of Philadelphia. Give me the Jews who have America. Sure. I'm not sure. Well, actually, I'm not really sure. I don't know if he's aware that there was significant intermarriage, certainly. But I want the Jews who can trace themselves to the War of Independence. Now, there were only 1,000 Jews living in the United States, in Charleston, in Baltimore, in Philadelphia, in New York, around the Revolutionary War. Many of the Jews in New York, of course, had to escape during British occupied New York to Philadelphia, to Mikveh Israel. In fact, their minister, Gershom Mendes Seisius, left there by way of Connecticut. I know it doesn't make sense geographically, made his way, and they really came and huddled in Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia. I want those Jews, those Israelites, those Hebrews. What's important also is that even though these were Jews who gravitated towards the Spanish Portuguese community, it was a long time ago that the majority, and really when they really start to get going, these communities are predominantly German migrants. I work at Graz College. Barnard and Michael Graz are born in Europe. They are Ashkenazic. Chaim Solomon, who we can debate how critical he was and sort of was the imagined Chaim Solomon. There are many Jews in Philadelphia, New York, and in Charleston who are really of Ashkenazic descent, but they adopt the establishment, the Spanish Portuguese Nusach, their minhagim, their customs, the trappings, their sensibilities, because they too see that there is what Ismar Sharsh has called a Sephardic supremacy. There is this idea that it's more elegant, it's more regal, it's also more authentic. I, full disclosure, Ashkenazic Jew, daven Ashkenazic shuls. But that is the perception, certainly at that time. And it's in reinforcing certain sentiments about who is the in-Jew and who is the out-Jew. Thought I saw something in the chat. Correct. Savannah also has an old Jewish community. I think its history book is called Third to None. No matter how you count the first of American Jewish life, we're up there. Correct. Savannah is also part of it. When and from where did Seligman News Answer come from? Bavaria, from German area. He's not from Prussia. Correct. What I said is that there is a, they themselves call themselves German, although there wouldn't be a Germany until 1871. Many come from not Prussia, but actually southern German area from villages at the time. Prussia actually accepts Jews much earlier on. So then who are the Jews associated with? So let's look at some characters, some figures. So on your left is Isaac Meir Weiss. Again, I introduced him as the architect of Reform Judaism. Here is Felix Adler, who is the son of a prominent rabbi and is trained in Europe, and he's expected to take over his father's pulpit and become the heir, so the scion of American Reform Judaism. And here's Kaufman Kohler, who succeeds Isaac Meir Weiss of Hebrew Union College. So again, if you look at my cursor, Weiss, Adler, and Kohler. Adler studies in Europe, and he comes back. Again, this is the Dauphin Prince of American Judaism, particularly Reform Judaism. Everybody has high expectations for him. And Adler says, I don't want any of it. I'm not a moderate reformer like Wise. I'm not a radical reformer like Kohler. Kohler had actually, when he was in Chicago, had shifted his Shabbat to Sunday. I believe Sinai Congregation in Chicago still observes Shabbat on Sunday. And so he's a radical reformer, very much like his father-in-law, David Einhorn. Felix Adler says, I don't want any of it, but I do like Sundays. So what I'm interested in is ethical culture. What I'm in there still, ethical culturists in New York. There's a beautiful building that was Adler Center, and he lives a very, very long time. And he creates almost a secularized ritual. And there's a devotion to German culture and German music. It's very edifying. He adopts what Germans call Bildung, which is cultural education. And there is a religious motif to the experience. There is a ritual that is built around a certain liturgy or a certain sense of wisdom writings, particularly German modern sensibilities. There is music. So there is sort of the template of a religious experience on a Sunday morning. But Adler doesn't have much truck for ideas of God. And to the chagrin of the leaders of the Reform movement, is capturing the imagination of many Jews, young and old. And the leader, the lay leader of his group, is Joseph Seligman. There's also a women find a place there in ethical culture. He's a brilliant orator. He's a professor at Cornell. And Felix Adler does quite well. And that really upsets the Reform more than the stagnant Orthodox community, because the Reform are betting on capturing the same imagination of Jews, of young people, middle-aged and young people, to come to them. They've made all of these changes in Judaism to create and to grow Reform Judaism. And they've taken certain a protocol, moved it in and out of religious practice. They've modified the Siddur, the prayer book. They think that they're going to become the leader of American Judaism. And in fact, by and large, they are. But Felix Adler poses a problem. Well, for Henry Hilton, it was bad enough for him that there were these, so that that there were these Jews who do not comport themselves like the erstwhile Spanish Portuguese Jews, or the people at least who affiliate with the Spanish Portuguese community of the colonial and the early republic. For him, Seligman not only is identified at one point with the Reform movement, but he, in his estimation, Hilton's, is even worse. He's part of this secularized movement, and that's a reminder of just how devout or how traditional America was from a religious vantage point. Felix Adler was also grabbing non-Jews into his Sunday services. So Seligman was the biggest, one of the largest patrons and philanthropists to Felix Adler. Now, what's interesting is these are the Jews. These are Israelites and Hebrews. This is what Hilton himself imagines is a Hebrew or an Israelite. People who had just passed away in the beginning decades of the 19th century. And these are Jews. Hebrews and Israelites. Jews. And that's why I raised Isaac Mayer Wise's comment that he is now the new Orthodox Jew. But it's all a matter of perspective. These folks are well-groomed. I don't know if anybody keeps a mustache the way that Wise does any longer. These are well-groomed. You know, he's wearing his spectacles, his glasses, collar on our right, are dignified. Their hair, not Wise's, but their hair is well-combed. They're not wearing yarmulkes. They're wearing multiple-piece suits. These are not people who grew out of the shtetl. This is not the stuff of Fiddler on the Roof, but it's a matter of perspective. These are the Jews, and he's looking to other people as Henry Hilton, and other, in a burgeoning sentiment of anti-Semitism, is looking at these people and saying, you know what? You're not authentic. And for there couldn't be anything more crushing for these group of liberal religious leaders than to be denied a level of authenticity. And so it was critical for Seligman that what he was being shut out because he was less than authentic. He wasn't the type of Jew that a guy like Henry Hilton wanted in his hotel. Let me just stop here and see if there are any questions. Leave a space. I don't see anything in the chat. All right, I'll reshare. So Wise goes on the offensive in his newspaper, The American Israelite. What does he, referring to Hilton, what does he mean by the trade Jews? Is not he himself a trade Christian? Speak not of upstarts, for what are you? Look not down upon smaller traders, that others look not down upon you. Indeed, there are men superior to Henry Hilton, but they are so far superior to him that they would be ashamed to look down upon him or a common beggar. Let the trade Jew, now again, Wise is in a very strange place. He's defending Seligman. Seligman is supporting Adler, supporting the ethical culture movement to the detriment of Reform Judaism. Let the trade Jew alone. There are Jewish, says glaziers, in the streets of New York who, in intelligence and nobility of heart, outshine Henry Hilton as Venus outshines Mercury. Please do not think too much of yourself. You are, after all, no more than a lucky man. A.T. Stewart gave him control of the space. Truly, you have been the instrument in the hands of Providence to teach those Jews that with all their apostasy, they must remain Jews, only more despised in their faithlessness and folly. Truly, your Haman-like decree was a godsend to rouse those Jews to the consciousness that in the hour of need, they must have the Jew anyhow, that money does not make it. I see there's a question. Yes, I believe that Chicago Sinai still has observed Shabbat on Sunday. Social predecessors in the same column, again, September 1877. The Hilton-Seligman controversy again calls our attention to the social prejudices of some Native American Christians. They don't mean Native Americans like Native Americans. They mean people, again, who multi-generational Christian Americans against foreign-born Hebrews. He's Bullock saying the language. Foreign-born Hebrews. To Hilton, these are Jews, not Hebrews. Especially in the eastern cities, where know-nothingism, of course, a very sense of entrenched nativism, has left its imprints in social life. Two facts which experience teaches must be taken into consideration. Number one, the Native American Israelite, it's kind of a funny thing, the Native American Israelite is not exposed to those prejudices, not even in the eastern cities. And two, these social prejudices exist chiefly or perhaps exclusively in eastern cities. It's very much a waspy New England, New York type, you know, Yankee type of thing. And there again, they are they're most outspoken in Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. Outside of Boston, those are the major hubs of Jewish life. In the West, these ridiculous prejudices could not exist to any considerable extent because the foreign element is too numerous and influential, and the West has been thoroughly liberalized by men who understood that business. One of the interesting comments, and we'll close with this observation, with Berthold Auerbach, the very important German writer, short story essayist at the time. This is a translation of a letter he wrote at the time into English. And now, one more word. So this is the vantage point of the view from a Jew living in Europe. Certainly, it is beyond question. There is much to criticize in the Jews on both sides of the ocean. Above all, they often lack that quiet culture that finds fulfillment in the inward processes of ennoblement and growth. The reigning passion is for show and ostentation, particularly among the Jewish women. Again, his opinion on mine. Much work must be done. Much advice must be given if simplicity and modest sense of citizen's duty are to be implanted and cultivated. Essentially saying is that he had the privilege of entering into the literary elite company of Europe, and he was an exception that proved the overall rule. But do we not find the same in the corresponding Christian classes, not unique to Jewish people, who have come into wealth? In any event, and that's part of what's so challenging, Seligman was one of the most wealthy people in the United States, and that he could be barred despite his assets was defied a certain socioeconomic sensibility. He had the currency. In any event, a man like Mr. Hilton certainly has no call here to act as an educator. Should, however, his measure be indeed based upon the testamentary arrangement, no state resting upon moral foundations would protect and execute a will which so clearly violates the eternal norms of the moral law, claiming that he was following the will of A.T. Stewart, which is not so. One more word of advice might be given to the Jews of America. This is the thrust of it. Let not this attempt to mock everything meaningful in life keep them from sowing the seeds of good in their new fatherland, and from showing themselves worthy of being free citizens. Above all, however, they must not give up if their Christian fellow citizens, as is indeed possible, do not fulfill their obligation to oppose with all their might this first budding of a moral plague. This, dear friend, written in haste, is my answer from the Alps to your call from Rissenberg. Now, it didn't change much. Before we look at some final images, what this upset was the convention of how to make it in American life if you were a Jew. The idea that America is different, that America was exceptional, that somehow you could make it financially didn't necessarily mean that you could make it socially, according to Henry Hilton. You could become wealthy, but you had no chance to upgrade your social class. And that's what really, really upset American Jewish sensibilities. That's why if we go back to Howe versus Cohen at the beginning of Howe, yeah, it's true. Seligman, people forgot about it after a couple of years. There was another instance, actually, of a prominent barring of a Jew from a hotel a few years later in which it conjured up feelings and people rehearsed the episode of Seligman Affair. But in fact, it was not systemic in any way, although we do see, for example, a hint to the Hebrews, how they make themselves independent of the watering place hotels. This is later on, a few decades later. There was certainly a tradition of anti-Semitism, which is fueled, again, you date it all the way back to the Civil War, but certainly from Hilton and Seligman onward, there was significant increases in anti-Jewish prejudices. But what upset them most was it really called into question the blueprint for making it in American Jewish life. This is a parody. I'm grateful to my friends at the American Jewish Archives for scanning for me. Down with the Jews, meeting of the Society for Suppressing the Jewish Race, a terrible plot against the chosen people. This is before the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. A meeting of the American Society for the Suppression of the Jews was held on Tuesday evening last in the blue parlor of the Grand Union Hotel at Saratoga. This is like Perm Tar over here. Mr. Henry Hilton, this is again, Jews had made it as a parody. Mr. Henry Hilton presided, and Mr. Austin Coburn acted as secretary. Max L. Besavalli made a few preliminary remarks and argued the best way to suppress the Jews was to convert them to Christianity, as he had been converted while serving a term in the Albany, parliamentary. Mr. Coburn objected and introduced any religious element into the discussion. He objected to any type of religious talk, claiming that the society opposed the Jew only as a nasty and vulgar race and not an account of their religion. That's what's so interesting, is that anti-Semitism was shifting, certainly in the United States, from a one that was motivated by religious intolerance to one of social standing. And that scared many Reformed Jews and liberal Jews, and all types of Jews, truly, because it added a new dimension. And that's exactly why the Seligman Affair was so powerfully violent and terrible. He thought, however, that the time had come for nice and refined Christians to put themselves on record as utterly opposed to the toleration of Jews in American society. Is this a free country? Said the speaker. Why can't we be free of the Jews? Loud applause. Mr. Hilton, taking the floor, said that he quite agreed with the previous speaker. The Jews in America were becoming like their ancestors in Egypt, too numerous and powerful to be tolerated. So it became a social thing rather than a religious one. And for that reason, the Seligman-Hilton affair really represented a change regime in the history of anti-Semitism in the United States. Of course, certainly should state that the history of Jews in the United States has been exceptional, although I'm certainly not willing to tolerate anti-Semitism. Gratz operates the world's first graduate program in anti-Semitism studies, after all. But we have to be relative to what's going on in historical context. At the same time, even in America, and that was what was most unsettling, was that somebody like a Seligman, well-heeled, powerful, connected politically, a banker, could somehow not be, not just that he could face the impact of rising anti-Semitism, but his type was somehow less in than other Jews, upset all formulations and social calculations of how to make it as a Jew in the United States. And for that, it remains a pivotal tension point and watershed moment in American Jewish history. Thank you so much. I think we have a few moments for questions.
Hello.
I mean, yes.
Yes,
please.
I'm from England, the north of England.
No anti-Semitism over there.
Loads. What I was going to say was that we have the same type of immigration of Jews, Sephardi, then German, then East. Sephardi mainly married into the aristocracy, the British aristocracy, including the royal family, and sort of died out Jewishly. I don't know about Germans so much. But you haven't actually mentioned German Orthodoxy. I don't know whether that was as bigger, you know, maybe that's irrelevant. But what I do want to say, as I do a lot of dialogue groups with Christians, sadly, the Christian words that you read at the end, you didn't read it all, about how we were like the Jews in Egypt, you know, with Joseph and all that, and too powerful, Exodus, Shemot. That's being said now by the church in this country, which is very powerful. The church in England, you know, is very powerful. The Archbishop of Canterbury has just been sacked or had to resign over some things that went on, and in its first time ever. But it must not be, you know, not taken for granted. But I'm interested in that we have the parallel, same year, more or less, in the 17th century. Jews allowed in through Holland, Menasseh ben Yisrael, and it's a very different approach. But there's always been social, you know, exclusion of Jews, including
this
now.
This is very much a story about the Atlantic. Right. There's this very American historians like to think about a whole Atlantic region and certainly migration of certain types, starting from Amsterdam and then Germany, both to the United States. And many Jews, because if they couldn't afford, I mentioned the tremendous expense of traveling from Europe to the United States, many Jews, if they couldn't afford that, would start peddling in England. They would sell their oranges and they would work their way up to then migrate.
That's right.
To Canada and the United States, and many Jews just stayed, either they liked it or they couldn't make it. So there's the parallels are very appropriate and are expected.
Thank you.
All right, everybody.
If you look up the Wikipedia article on Henry Hilton, you'll find reference to this, and you'll also find reference to the fact that he was an executor for somebody, got $1 million for it, and then presided over the dissipation of one of the largest fortunes created by trade.
A.T. Stewart gave him a lot of money, and Henry Hilton was no good. There's no question about that. But that itself is not doesn't warrant a longer historical
research.
No,
but it means that he ended up with less money, which is good. I mean, in his
time. Oh, okay.
Are you saying that this thing caused the view of Jews to change from not liking them because of our religion, where conversion isn't going to help, and going to race, that this is the start of we're no good because we're of a particular race as opposed to a particular religion?
I am saying not that it started it, but it was a cause celeb. It was a major moment, because it became crystal clear that that was happening. you could point to Ulysses S. Grant and General Orders Number 11 as Jews as a class being eliminated from his military encampment. There are other instances as well. But the fact that it wasn't that Joseph Salomon could also be a victim of anti-Semitism, but he himself was a particular life, he was on the outs. It threw light on an emerging situation and a change in anti-Semitism. This did not cause it, but it became a touch point in better understanding that.
Thank
did
you.
He have any connection with, did he retain any connection with Sarasota Spring after this incident?
Oh, I don't know. It's a good question. I doubt it.
Because
Hilton remained in charge for a number of years.
There is a branch of the Seligman family in Sarasota Springs to this day. There are Seligmans. How do I know? Because I am a Seligman on my mother's side. In fact, my name, Asher Zelig, the first part of my name, Asher Zelig, I am named after a Seligman.
Is it Joseph Seligman's family?
I don't know.
I would love to find out.
You would like to find out? Well,
if you have any connection, we'll talk offline. This is
my cousin is sort of the family archivist, and somewhere I have an essay that my mother did all about this. So there's,
you know what? So you proved something. Normally I say to myself, I'm on solid footing when I talk about or write about the 19th century, that nobody is alive who can contradict me. Now I know that I'm not even safe in the 19th century. But please do let me know. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day. And be careful where you want a vacation.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you.